Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Salary Report. Today is February 9th. This is publishing on February 10th. This is Money and Markets with Catherine Austin Fitz and John Titus. Wow. It's I would say it's an intense environment, John Titus.
Yeah, it's getting more intense by the week. All around too. It's not just like the crackdowns and the censorship and the stuff you see. It's just the bubbles. Right?
Yeah. So our theme today is
the bubbles float closer to the control grid.
Right.
Like these bubbles are wafting through the air. They're about to hit the power lines.
Well, it's funny because the part of this was inspired by my 3-hour conversation on Bitcoin with Mercola and sort of a Bitcoin lover. And you know, I've lived through many different bubbles. And one of the things that I've experienced is whenever you're making bubble money in a bubble, you're a genius and everything's fine. And you don't see either the bubble bursting and you don't see the control grid coming up to get you. And we're watching all these different bubbles because they're bubbles, you know, basically every asset category on the planet has been bubbled by the central bankers as they're playing this game.
You got it.
So we've got bubbles galore and the bubbles galore, everybody's sort of in a trance and then the control grid is coming and you think, oh, this is really going to be ugly.
Yeah. Everybody's a genius until the door closes.
Right.
And then they get to have their Wile E. Coyote moment of, oh.
So a subscriber just posted, you know, we put the interview up at Salary, and a subscriber just posted a comment. They made money on Bitcoin. You know how long it took him to get the money out?
How? No.
A year and a half.
You got to be kidding me.
No. They were trying to transfer it to an account. The Bitcoin account on the exchange, they had it on an exchange, was in their name. And then the account they were trying to transfer to was a joint account with their wife. So
let that be a lesson to you, laddie.
They froze it. And of course, you have to communicate online. There's no, you know, you can't get a human to talk to. It took a year and a half before they could get their sales proceeds.
Yeah, that's about how long it takes me to get paid by my law firm. You know?
Sticky. We used to call the investments like that the Roach Motel. Yeah. There's, you know, you can get in, but you can't leave.
That's funny.
Okay. So, but there's no liquidity problem, right?
No.
Okay. So let's dive in. We've got bubbles. We've got bubbles galore to look at.
Yeah. And we've got Farmageddon. We're going to bat lead off as always with Farmageddon. This story from the Wall Street Journal, Democratic Senator Ben Ray Lujan hospitalized for stroke. Let me zoom in here. Check this out. Senator Ben Ray Lujan, Democrat from New Mexico, suffered a stroke and had surgery to ease swelling in his brain. His top aide said Tuesday, here's the punch to the Democrats, right. Leading Democrats short of a crucial vote in the 50-50 Senate while he recovers.
Right.
That's a big deal. And, you know, his Twitter feed was full of, oh, I'm fully vaccinated. I got the booster, you know, at least one booster, maybe two. But there's no linkage shown in the story or explained in the story,
right.
Nor no evidence that I know of. But the guy, if you look at the story, he's a young guy. I mean, you know, this guy, right. He's 49 years old, not even 50, you know?
Right. And
so
here's the interesting thing, you know, Taking a Democratic vote out at a time like this, that is a very big deal and can impact a lot. But it's nothing compared to what's going to happen in November if we get a Republican landslide, which it certainly looks like we will. We'll get a Republican House and Senate if the vote was today.
Right.
And then you're talking about a huge swing in policies. I mean, a very big swing.
That his absence alone is going to be a big problem for the Democrats now.
Right.
And prospectively, since obviously the sharks in the water know, you got a man down. What, you know, what are you going to do?
Right.
You know, a tie vote. What tie are you talking about?
Right.
You know, Vice President Harris can't. There is no tiebreaker vote to be cast.
When you have a situation like that, though, when somebody gets a stroke, it makes me nervous, wondering if it's natural. So,
right,
could have been the vaccine, but
who knows? You just don't know. But that's a major kind of political, changes the political landscape a lot.
Right.
But that'll be interesting to watch how that plays out. The votes in the Senate, you know. Anyway, let's keep it going. Boy, we're going to have kind of two segments on this. The FDA wants to approve Pfizer mRNA shots for 19 million kids ages 6 months to 4 years. This announcement came out basically January 31st. Pfizer wants their disastrous mRNA shot added to the official schedule for children so that they can have liability protection forever.
Yep.
By the way, the Pfizer mRNA shot in children 2 to 4 years old failed in the clinical trial. Oh, good to know. So, So let's talk about the, you know, why it is that piece by Toby Rogers, that's the author of that piece, incidentally, says, you know, they want liability protection forever. So what we have a clip from RFK Jr., who does a good job explaining what, you know, why they would get liability protection. So let's, I want to cut to that clip and let me zoom in. There we go. Can you see that pretty well?
Yep.
Okay. Let's roll this clip. This is, I guess this interview is in Brussels.
This is at the Washington Monument.
Oh, okay. The speaker sounds foreign, but her English is very good. Anyway, let's listen to this explanation. It's very good by RFK.
Mr. Kennedy, many of the parents later regret having their children and adolescents vaccinated. And we see, like you said, so many children get injured and even die. But at the same time, we know that parents cannot seek for any justice for what is happening, because the vaccine manufacturers are completely shielded by the federal government from any liability. Do you believe that this law should be overturned, maybe scrapped completely?
Of course it should be overturned. And if you want to know why there is such a strong, fierce drive to vaccinate children, you have to understand how the law works. Under the CARES Act and the PREP Act, emergency use authorization vaccines are protected from liability. So as long as it's an EUA vaccine, you can't sue them, no matter how reckless their conduct, no matter how grievous your injury, no matter how negligent they are, you cannot sue them. Once it becomes an approved vaccine, that shield, that immunity, freedom from immunity disappears, and we will be able to sue them. Unless it's a recommended vaccine for children. Because under the Childhood Vaccine Act, any vaccine that is recommended for children automatically receives immunity from liability, even when that vaccine is given to an adult. So Pfizer knows that it cannot afford to give an approved vaccine to any American, because people, attorneys like me, will sue them and bankrupt them overnight. We will make them pay for the entire pandemic. But if they can get it approved for children, then they'll get immunity from liability, and they will not have to deal with the consequences of their behavior.
Wow. Right. So just to summarize that really quickly, there's two gates for the pharmaceutical companies to get to immunity, to legal immunity. One is it's an emergency use. The other is it's a childhood vaccine. It's recommended for children. Right. Either one of those two, no liability. And you heard him say, even if it's just recommended to children, the liability blanket spreads over everybody. It covers
adults.
So why
do they want this? What Pfizer wants is they want the liability protection. What the administration wants is to be able to mandate. And they get it. They have a much better chance of getting mandates done if it's an approved vaccination instead of an emergency use authorization.
Right.
But the question is, how do they get the mandate without Pfizer, you know, still getting, how did they get the mandate with Pfizer still getting the liability protection? And this is what they're doing. And if you look at what came out last year about all-cause mortality and children being raised by giving them these injections, this is fraud. This is really, really fraud. So that video was in an article, or just a thing I posted, because I emailed every member that's going to be voting on that decision and basically, you know, sent them a notice of liability saying, you know, you may think the Department of Justice and the insurance companies are going to protect you from this, but you're not, you know, you're not free from the laws of God or what your neighbors are going to think or do when they find out what you've done and done to them. I mean, because people are dying all over the country.
Yeah.
It's remarkable.
Right. There's a long line of legal precedent where anything that rests on a fraud, meaning but for the fraud, X, right. Y, or Z would have happened, it's open to be taken down, including entire litigations sometimes could be taken down.
Well, if you look at Moderna's, we're going to look at it later, but if you look at Moderna's stock price,
yeah,
but it says to me somebody's worried.
Namely, people with money who've no longer investing in Moderna.
You know? Right, right.
Yeah, that would be it. Okay, yeah. Let's keep it going. Over to the Army. Army to begin involuntary separations for 3,300 soldiers who refused COVID vaccine. This is interesting to me, just the numbers involved. The Army has begun to eject soldiers who have refused a COVID-19 vaccine and have not received an official exemption. As of Wednesday, 3,350, you know, active duty Army soldiers and reserve soldiers on active orders are due to be involuntarily separated. Less than 1% of the force is affected. And then they give you some other numbers down here. As of January 26th, the Army is still processing basically 6,000 requests for exemption on various grounds. If those are denied, they're going to get kicked out too. The Air Force has separated at least 87 airmen. The Navy has separated 45 sailors. And the Marine Corps has separated nearly 400 Marines, which is interesting. Those numbers strike me as kind of low. But
they're very low.
As they also strike me, with that Marine Corps bit, the numbers there, like, you know, double digits and then 400 for the Marines, as credible. Because if you're going to get hardhead, you know, hard ass, that's the branch. You know, my old man was a Marine. He was a combat guy from Vietnam, and he was, you know, he was hardcore.
So, you know, the feedback I keep getting is that they are denying religious exemptions without grounds. And so I just can't imagine the U.S. military denying a soldier a religious exemption if they're eligible. And unfortunately, that appears to be what's happening.
Right.
Right.
Right. You know, it just, so you wonder, like, why... What's the strategy here with enforcing the injections in your own armed forces?
So there are two questions I have. What are the secret ingredients? So it either relates to the secret ingredients or you want to destroy the military.
Right. That's a fair inference. You know, right. I mean, those numbers, you know, I think both of us are reacting to them in the same way. They seem very low. Which tells me that the propaganda efforts within the military to get people injected are very high.
Right.
Those numbers strike me as, you know, you saw the Army article, less than 1%. If that's true, and who knows, we may be, you know, I think you take that with 2 tons of salt. But if that's true, less than 1%, I mean, that's 10 times over, well over 10 times the effectiveness of propaganda in the military over what it is in the civilian population.
Right.
Very, you know, so I don't
know. Well, it makes it look like they're just trying to scare everybody into getting the shots.
And they're doing a really good job in the military. That does not leave me with a warm, fuzzy feeling about the military.
Right. So the other thing is, what you're doing is you're culling out the people you most want to lead the military.
Right.
Right.
Right. It's like, what's a great way to find our independent thinkers? Hey, I've got it. Let's inject them with an undisclosed substance manufactured by a criminal enterprise and see how many say no.
Right.
And we'll just throw them out.
Right.
Yeah. Well done.
So it either comes down to they want the secret ingredients in your body or they're trying to destroy the U.S. military or both.
Right.
There's no other plausible explanation for
There's no other, right. You're not leaving me many options here.
Right.
Okay. Not a happy story, that one.
No. Genocide is never a pretty story.
No, exactly. Right. And, you know, and if you're gonna have a genocide, you know, why not? You know, why not wipe out the
military? Well, here's the thing. You know, we've talked about Skidmore Survey, and I'm hoping it'll be published this month. But one thing that's clear when you look at either the results of the test survey or the final survey, that I told you that was the day I started to use the word genocide. This is a genocide. So
Right. Okay. All right, let's keep it going. Next story, the Great Resignation and COVID-19 impact on public sector employment and how employers can help. Let's see if I can zoom in a little bit. Yeah, it barely fits in. Public sector employees who are considering leaving their job, 52%. I mean, look at these, 36% changing jobs, 33% retiring, you know, age 60 plus, you see that? You know,
right.
So a lot of early retirements, 28% leaving the workforce entirely for the foreseeable future. Then they have these trends, changing jobs. You can see clearly starting from May of 2020, a major, major uptick, 20%. On up to 36%. You know, why employees are leaving. Top three reasons. Want higher salary or better benefits package. Maybe a package that doesn't include, you know, Russian roulette game every 3 months. 47% feel burned out from the stress of job during pandemic. 36%. Anyway, this is it's a very interesting infographic. With a lot of information. I think
there's a complex basket of things going on here.
Yeah.
One is the more the banks and corporations move in and take over government functions, it becomes more and more unpleasant to work in government in that environment. So there are a series of things going on that make it more unpleasant. You're in a position where you have to enforce policies you don't believe in and don't make sense. I mean, a lot of people went into government, in my experience, to make the world better. They didn't go in to, you know, mandate masks to their neighbors. You know, then you're having your health, you know, these health policies and mandates forced on you. And then I think, to be blunt, you have a fair amount of vaccine injured and, you know, people who have to retire.
Yeah.
They can't work now. So
right.
I don't think it's one thing. I think it's lots of different things, but the friction in the system is forcing people out.
Yeah. So the link obviously will be in the show notes, however you want to describe it. But to me, the most significant, the 20 to 36% uptick there you saw in people leaving is that's pretty heavy.
Right. Our hero next week is the gentleman in the security dealer. He's a Monte. So the Canadian Monty's, he was in the security detail for Trudeau, and he resigned. I think we've got a story
this week.
Yeah. And, you know, but that's a perfect example of a guy who just, there's too much friction, and he says, I'm out.
Right. Right.
Right.
And we'll get to his reasons for they're very principled.
Right.
It's just like, you know, I mean, you keep saying you want Americans to say, you know, I'm here to uphold the Constitution and to fight enemies foreign and domestic.
Right.
That's it. And this guy basically gives the Canadian version of that.
Right.
Saying he's trampling all of our rights. But we'll get to that in due course. Right now, let's go to over your neck of the woods, Europe. The coronavirus. The Commission proposes to extend the EU digital COVID certificates by 1 year. Today, the European Commission is proposing to extend the EU digital COVID certificate by a year until basically next summer. Extending the regulation will ensure that travelers can continue using their EU digital COVID certificate when traveling in the EU, where member states maintain certain public health measures. I'm laughing because they always make it try to sound like it's your for your benefit. It will ensure that travelers can continue to use these wonderful coupons. This is interesting. The domestic use of EU digital COVID certificates remains a matter for member states to decide individually.
I wanted to discuss this because you're seeing all over Europe people backing down on the COVID restrictions and the general population thinking, oh, you know, it's getting better. It's, you know, this is all going away. Meantime, the control grid, they're changing the names, they're prepackaging their marketing, and there's more and more of an effort to roll out the control grid. And it's very important that we understand if that control grid snaps into place, thousands of mandates and restrictions are going to be rolling down on our head forever.
Right.
So, you know, stop that control grid. And there's, if you look at anything, they're doubling down on the control grid all over the world, including in Europe.
Including in the US.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So this thing about, oh, the COVID restrictions are going away.
Yeah,
no,
exactly.
They're locking a control grid into place so that they're going to, you know, they're going to be able to roll thousands of restrictions down on your head.
Right. It seems like a victory, and it is. You know, it's a battle that we've won, but do not lose sight of the war.
Right.
You do not want to be
trapped.
Don't
lose the war.
In this game of Tron, where, you know, you're nothing but an electronic motorcycle that could be wrecked at someone's leisure, right?
Right.
Okay. Next story, this military lawyer says genetic changes from COVID-19 vaccines are creating a new human species under the law. This is a long video here. It doesn't really behave that well. So I'll just let you summarize this one.
So I wanted this story in because I continue to be concerned that there's some kind of game around getting, you know, genetically modifying a human and that giving someone somewhere legal rights. In other words, there's something going on with the secret ingredients, the patents around the secret ingredients in the mRNA technology that makes me very nervous, including, you know, there are protocols that say a GMO good can't transfer national boundaries without certain travel restrictions. That's been one of the concerns that it might pop up in the travel context. Anyway, this is a military lawyer who's very concerned about that and goes through sort of his issues. And I thought it was worth noting because I think there's something here. I just don't have it yet. And I want us to all keep watching out because this is exactly the kind of thing the bankers would do is assert you put humans on a blockchain, you assert under patent law the right to use them as collateral and discern ownership. We saw a big explosion in the UK. One of the broadcasters, I think it was Julie Hartley, realized that her daughter, who'd been forced to take a PCR test, the private companies now had the DNA information and were selling it and had the legal right to do so. She went ballistic.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's something going on here, and we all just need to keep an eye on it and figure out what it is.
Right. You're exactly right about Wall Street being willing to do something like that, collateralized
right.
human beings, for instance. You know, I'm working on the sovereignty paper now, and I can tell you money, historically, slaves have been used as money before.
Absolutely.
It's not like this is unprecedented. And remember, from the 2008 crisis, you know, Wall Street was more than willing to bet against, you know, 5,000 home mortgages at a time in those debt
right.
pools, right?
Right.
And to take out insurance policies on them. You don't think they're going to take insurance policies out on people and, you know, whether they're going to survive or not?
Right.
You're dreaming. Where's the, why would they bet against human, you know, the people's mortgages? They're willing to do that, but they're unwilling to bet against people's lives?
Right.
I just don't see the line there. With the psychopaths, there is no line.
Right.
That's
there
an imaginary line. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Next story about life insurance. This is interesting. Just the numbers involved. This is from G. Edward Griffin's Need to Know. G. Edward Griffin, of course, being the author of Creature from Jekyll Island. Life insurance payouts skyrocketed last year as deaths surged in 2021 following vaccine rollout. This is from a Reuters story, but that story wouldn't behave when I pulled it up. With all these pop-ups and you got to subscribe. The global life insurance industry reportedly paid out $5.5 billion in just the first 9 months of 2021, a 157% increase over the $3.5 billion in payouts made for the entire year in 2020. That is unbelievable.
Because we keep seeing reports from insurance companies that the death claims are dramatically rising in 2021. So it's still early, but if the early, say the four or five reports I've seen continue, John, You know, that's a number. You can suppress all sorts of death statistics. You can suppress all sorts of stuff, but you cannot suppress what's happening in the life insurance companies. And they, the life insurance companies have tremendous political power. So they're not going to get hung with this. And of course, because it's emergency use authorization, we know they have outs.
Right.
So they're either going to start taking those outs, or they're going to go to the government and ask the government to basically bail them out on the injections. But either way, you can't keep this secret. You can't keep this covered up, whether you do a bailout or you start legally to just kind of stick it back to the beneficiaries. They're going to have to do something because
Right.
they can't afford the drain that's going to is about to occur.
Yeah, in other words, the margins can't be that fat in the life insurance industries.
No.
There's too many insurers,
Well, not
right?
only are they not that fat, they've been getting clocked by interest rates. Now, rising interest rates will help them, but between lower interest rates and what the death rates could be, they have a serious problem.
Yeah, I would say so.
Right.
I mean, to give you an idea of how big a problem, I'm going to cut back to the story real quick. To give an example here, Dutch insurer Aegon, which does 2/3 of its business in the U.S., said its claims in the Americas in the third quarter were $111 million, up from $31 million a year earlier. And then there's a trade association reported to Reuters that Americans who held life insurance policies suffered 12% more deaths than average in 2020. So you can see the 12% and more deaths is translating to, huge increases in payouts. Not sure
Right.
why that is, but that's not a good picture for that industry.
Well, keep an eye on the life insurance industry and the insurance industry because it's going to be, it's the tail that wags the dog. It's going to tell us a lot, and we should get a lot of information in the next 3 to 6 months.
Right. We're going to get a lot of information. We'll get a lot of information next month when we see whether or not the Fed starts to raise interest rates. I think they probably will do something very tiny, but you're right. We'll see what
They'll
happens
do
with interest
something.
rates.
They'll raise.
We'll get to that.
Okay.
There's an interesting story coming up. It's like, what? Okay, we'll get to it. This might be it right here. This is in FedWatch. Let me go to this story from the Journal. Wall Street Journal. As inflation soars, central banks scramble to lift rates. Okay? So the Bank of England raises rates, ECB leaves the door open. But check this. Listen, look at the wording of this. Let's see what they're saying here. Read this literally. Europe's central banks signaled growing concern about soaring inflation and a determination to quench it by raising interest rates, a policy shift that creates risks for investors and the world economy. The hawkish moves, okay? So remember, we all, the only move is concern and determination.
Yakety
Okay? That's now, that now counts as a move, okay? It won't come down as quickly as they thought. The moves and signals from Europe's central bankers Thursday rumbled through markets globally. This is unbelievable. With the euro and the pound strengthening 1% against the dollar, government bond markets selling off and stocks dropping on the prospect for tightening of policy in the months ahead. It's like, are you kidding me?
Makes
So
no
all they,
sense,
that that's a move. You
especially
just come
since
out
the
and
euro has been falling against the dollar. So I don't know. It
all you
doesn't
have
make
to
any
do
sense because it's just yakety yak.
you, I'm going to give those interest rates a good dressing down. The market's like, what do you, what? Look at that move. Did you hear that? I mean, the whole thing is just, it's what a charade, isn't it?
Is.
The next story, this is an older one, from of Dollars and Cents, the greatest asset bustle bundle of all time. Stories from June of 2019. But take a look at these, the greatest asset bubbles of all time, according to this guy. Here they are. Number one, tulip mania. That's not long after the Central Bank of Amsterdam. Number two, South Sea. That's not long after the Bank of England, 1694. Number three, Great Crash. That's not long after the Fed started in 1913, and so on. And then Bitcoin, he's got down here, number seven. What do you make of all those?
So I just wanted to put this in because I do think we, you know, you've had the central banks bubble everything. Right. So I would say that we're not, you know, we're in an everything bubble. And it's frightening to me because when you get in these kind of bubbles, the market prices signal behavior to people that is irrational. In other words, they act against their own best interest. So, you know, so you spend 20 years making money in the bubble, and then by the time you come out of the bubble, you know, the only option you have for food is insects and synthetic food. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So there's all sorts of missed signals, but I wanted to have this piece in because it's important to understand that we're dealing with bubble psychology, you know, whether it's, to me, it's in all asset categories. And you can tell from getting the questions that I get and ask Catherine, people are feeling very nervous about how do I navigate all these different bubbles? Because they can feel that it's, you know, the pricings don't make sense. And there's right. always the concern you're going to put your money in the bubble and then the bubble will pop. So one of the things I talk about every quarter in Equity Overview is, you know, how do you keep it real? So if you have questions about money, go listen to the Equity Overviews. I just did one last month. But there's no doubt in my mind, you know, in this interview that I did with Mercola on Bitcoin is a bubble. It's been bubbled with the Fed money. I mean, the central banks are printing. It's been bubbled with that money. As far as I know, it's the black budget money too. But it's clearly been bubbled by cheap money. And a lot of the folks trading it don't appreciate that or what would happen if that money, you know, went the other, if the tide pulled the other way. So, you know, I was talking with a guy on the interview who he bought Bitcoin and he supports himself. The way he gets income is he borrows against his Bitcoin position.
Right.
Now he's got a low loan to value ratio, but you know, Bitcoin is very leveraged. I just told you about the subscriber. It took a year and a half to get his money out.
Yeah.
You know, and I have other people who say it took me 2 weeks, it took me 4 weeks, it took me 3 months, it took me 6 months. So you have these long lead times to try and convert your money into fiat currency or into sovereign currency. And if the regulators get tough, it could get even worse. So, you know, just there are lots of different ways of navigating a bubble. But just remember, you know, you're navigating more than a few of them. And it's going to get much worse because inflation is with us.
Right. And you're exactly right about the bubble popping, it getting ugly. I go back to the legend of Bill Miller, the fund manager at Legg Mason, who beat the S&P 500 for something like 16, 17 years in a row. Now, he actually was a great genius because that is just statistically almost impossible. And yet you saw in 1 year, he not only,
right.
his entire 20-year performance reverts not to the middle of the pack, but basically on the bottom side of it in 1 year because he stayed in a bubble too long. And he got blowtorched.
So I started to write about the mortgage fraud in 1998. And I wrote about the mortgage fraud. And then in 2004, I started doing it was either a weekly or biweekly show in San Francisco that basically ran at 5 p.m. So it's, you know, everybody's in commuting, everybody's going home. And what I was talking about week after week after week as the former Assistant Secretary of Housing and the former lead financial advisor of the Department of Housing and Urban Development, I'm talking about the mortgage fraud. So in San Francisco, on commuter traffic hour, the former assistant secretary is describing the mortgage fraud week after week after week after week. Okay, now, I was also driving around the country, and there wasn't a trucker in America who didn't know how bad the mortgage fraud was. Do you know what I mean? It was common knowledge because It was unbelievable. As you know, you've seen some of the movies like The Big Short. It was unbelievable. Okay, so in 2008, I get thrown off the radio show for some bizarre reason. And right after that, they voted to do the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac bailout. Okay, and I know why they wanted me off because when they did the bailout. Okay, so right after the bailout, it comes out that the top, what I would say the most prestigious institutional money manager in San Francisco takes $1 billion loss on Fannie Mae stock. And they bought that position in April, 2008. And they put a letter up on their website explaining that they'd done very serious due diligence before they made the $1 billion purchase of, you know, all stock equity. And they had no idea that mortgage fraud was going on. Okay. So I'm like, wait a minute. The former assistant secretary of housing at 5 p.m. commuter has been on this show since 2004. That's 4 years. Talking about the mortgage fraud the whole time, but they don't know. They don't know what every trucker in America knows.
Yeah, right.
How can that be?
Not credible.
It was, you know, but that's what happens in a bubble.
Got
you get in a bubble and you hear your own, you know, you talk within the bubble to, you know, I remember in the 80s, you know, I'd go out to the Hamptons with all these traders and they thought they were geniuses because the Fed was just printing money and they everything was going up and they thought they were financial geniuses.
Yeah.
And listening to them and I remember thinking these guys are idiots. They have no idea.
No, there's that great interview in Inside Job by Charles Ferguson, movie about the financial fraud and the crisis. And there's the manager says, you know, I talked to these guys. I knew these guys working at Merrill Lynch, these funds. He says back in the 70s and early 80s, you know, they're taking part-time jobs as garbage men, you know, because to supplement their income, which is pretty low. But once the stock market gets rolling, you know, in the 80s, 90s, suddenly they think they're the greatest geniuses in the world. Nothing's changed.
Right.
Nothing. You get in the bubble. Yeah, you're a super genius until you're not.
Yeah, except when they're picking up garbage, they're learning real skills.
Right, exactly.
Real skills are going to come in useful.
Yeah. Oh, next story from Miami, Miami Herald. Let me zoom in. She makes 120 cocktails an hour and tells bad jokes. Meet your new robot bartender. I was hoping for a robot. I was very disappointed. It's really just one big, you could sort of see here, it's like a video game console.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, the robots are rising, but at least they're making us drinks. At least Cecilia is making us drinks. She looks like an arcade game, but pours like an angel. She tells bad jokes, asks if you prefer fruity or classy cocktails, and suggests the best way to drink tequila is as a shot with salt and lime, even as she pours you a margarita. She's about 7 feet tall, impervious to insults, and can serve 120 cocktails an hour. This is a little bit interesting, a bit of propaganda. Nor she's not trying to steal the jobs of future bartenders. Her job is to teach hospitality students at FIU's, I love this, Bacardi Center for Excellence, the school I think I was at for a while, about technology and innovation in their chosen field, and ultimately to help businesses sell more drinks. The idea of a robot bartender is not even close to reality, says Brian Connor. That's this guy. He's the director of the Bacardi Center. Anyway, that's the story of Cecilia, the robot bartender.
So
not trying
there's
to steal
huge
jobs
automation. Off. There's huge automation coming.
Yeah. Yes.
There's huge automation coming. And what's been amazing is it's all being developed and moved in sort of at the wholesale capacity, sort of in the, you know, it's going into a manufacturing facilities and people don't sort of feel it or notice it or see it because it's not touching retail as much, but it's about to explode out. And you want to get ready for it. Here it comes.
I love that bit of propaganda. She's just there to teach the students. The best 120 drink an hour, Cecilia. She's hers. Yeah. It's not about replacing jobs.
Right.
You know,
there you go.
Which you have to say because you're teaching the students who are trying to get those jobs.
Right.
That's a tough pitch, isn't it? Okay.
That is a very tough pitch.
Yeah. Like, hey, why aren't she could just work, you know, how much are you paying her? Okay. Next story, as we transition to space, military and global turf wars, is from Zero Hedge. Russia is prepared to declare economic war on the West, inflicting huge economic pain. This comes from Michael Every of Rabobank. We got to kind of scroll through this one to get to what's going on here. Basically, the West has no pressure point against Russia except the military, where it is outgunned. And Russia, this kind of talks about what's going on in the Ukraine. Russia just banned the export of ammonium nitrate for 2 months. So Russia clearly understands the geopolitical and geoeconomic pressure points that it controls. They can see the U.S. does not want to raise rates, but has to. They can also see that they can force inflation far higher, inflicting huge economic pain, even if they take some too. This is how economic war works. And then they quote this guy, a TV anchor who's a Kremlin mouthpiece, Dmitry Kiselov, known as the reliable mouthpiece, explained on air during the past weekend that the current crisis is not about Ukraine. The scale, he says, is much bigger. It's not entirely clear why this, what's going on here from this article, but I'll just highlight this point here. The U.S. must reflect on whether it can afford to reduce its presence in Europe before a proper counterweight to Russia has been created. There's one thing in here that I wanted to basically, these talks are going on. I'll just summarize it from memory. There's talks going on between Europe and the Ukraine, okay?
Right.
And the U.S. is not part of them.
Right.
Right. And between Russia and Europe and Ukraine, and the U.S. is not part of it. Right. And there's a speculation in this article that basically what Russia is reacting to, the reason for the troops, is send a signal to Europe, like, you know, don't be expanding NATO past your borders.
Right.
But I'm still, even after reading this, it's a little odd reading a piece on geopolitics coming out of a bank. I'm still unclear on what the Ukraine's all about.
So here's the issue. Europe depends on Russia for gas and oil. So
right.
The energy dependency on Russia is enormous. And part of the thing that triggered this is the Nord 2 pipeline is going in and the U.S. has tried very hard to stop it. But Germany and Russia and Europe need the gas, you know, need the gas. In fact, Switzerland just put out a warning that may have to cut electricity a lot because Germany is shutting down its nuclear plants. And so they're not going to sell as much electricity to be available to Switzerland. So there's real issues, and we keep getting warnings of energy shortages here in the Netherlands. So there's real issues of dependency on Russia for the energy and what Russia could do if the U.S. tries to bring more sanctions against Russia, and NATO keeps pushing. So you have, and part of it is, I think the Europeans are a lot more concerned about China than about Russia. And so Russia traditionally was going to be a bulwark against China. So the Europeans clearly have different vested interests than the U.S.
Yep.
And if the U.S. presses its interests, the way for Russia to push back is economically. So, and it's not just cutting Europe's energy, it's messing with the energy markets in a way that really messes with the derivatives. So you're talking about a currency war and how real assets on the ground change how that currency war could play out. And the U.S. is, I think the U.S. has, unless they're willing to use military weaponry, the U.S. has a surprisingly weak hand. So,
yeah.
Tried to centralize the world into an Asian bloc, a European bloc, and a sort of an Anglo-American bloc through the U.S. And the problem is that these centralized entities are fraying, and the European Union is fraying, and it's fraying up against the U.S. And so the centralizers are having trouble holding their position and not breaking out into different fights.
Yeah.
And what's happening with NATO and Russia is making that very, very uncomfortable. It's making it very uncomfortable for the European Union, and it's making it very uncomfortable for the relationship between the European Union and America. And what I want to know is, who in America are the Europeans dealing with?
That's a great question.
Right. Who do you try and make a deal with?
Well, let's hold that thought to go to our next story, because some of the points you raise are covered in the next story. And some of the points that I thought were in the Zero Hedge story from Michael Every are actually in the next story from Giza Death Star. And this concerns an admiral, a German vice admiral, K. Achim Schoenbach, who here and after will be referred to by his last name only. So the headline says it all. Okay, this is the story with this admiral. Russia is needed as a counterbalance to growing power of China. That's what you talked about. Right. Naval Chief Schoenbach conceded Russia is a pivotal part of his country and Europe's strategy to contain China in a severe blow to Ukraine's hope for support. Russia and Europe are scheduled to begin talks about Ukraine, talks to which the U.S. and NATO have not been invited, meaning something very significant. Europe and Russia are deeply, let me repeat, deeply divided over their respective visions of one, strategic threats, and two, Russia's role in European and global affairs. Europe is content to pursue trade agreements with both Russia and China, but is fully cognizant that Russia is the pivot power in the growing Eurasian trade bloc, and the only power with sufficient military and strategic depth to offset China, a depth that Europe knows that its trade and technology can only enhance. Mr. Putin, so here we get to what's going on in the Ukraine. Mr. Putin's troop buildups have nothing to do with threats of war and everything to do with making it very clear to European powers and members of NATO that Russia simply cannot tolerate any further NATO expansion to the east. They have everything to do with demonstrating to Europe that Europe's future with the American empire is increasingly dangerous and bleak. And there you have it. That's right. The most sense I've seen on the Ukraine out of all the stories I've read on it.
Right. Well, that's from Joseph Farrell.
Okay.
Right.
There you go. That explains it. So, you know, again, that's one of those things, one of the stories we'll have to come back to because it's ongoing and because there's still, to me, probably you too, a lack of clarity on what's going on.
You have all these, sort of the people at the top squabbling and threatening all sorts of stuff. If you look at the day-to-day practicality of getting the trains out on time and feeding the population, you know, that's what's going to drive this train, and everybody's going to have to cooperate or they're all going to starve. That's what's going to happen, or freeze to death. You know, and it's interesting because if Russia cuts off gas to Europe, that's it for the crypto.
Oh, right.
By crypto.
I hadn't thought of that connection.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Boy, is that a...
Well, think about it. Crypto uses, you know, there's a debate. I guess it was Bitcoin uses more energy than Switzerland and almost as much as Germany. So you think if 20% of the people in Europe don't have gas...
They don't have electricity.
Google servers in Iceland may have to get cut.
So
who do you think will get priority, search engines or food?
You know, there's times I wonder about that. I mean, obviously it'll be heat and food to, you know, carry the day. But the zeal of some crypto fans sometimes knows no bounds. But maybe they'll find a boundary in this story. I don't know. Let's go to the next story. This is from China. Last story in space military global turf wars. Chinese satellite reportedly grappled moved another spacecraft away from orbit. This from Sputnik. So yeah, there's not as much here as you might think. An analytics firm claimed to have seen a satellite grab another one and yank it from its orbit. China's Shijian 21 satellite vanished from view on January 22nd and resurfaced while performing a large maneuver to approach a dead Baidu navigation system satellite. The SJ-21 then yanked the Baidu from its orbit and deposited in a graveyard a few hundred kilometers away, where it is unlikely to interact or collide with satellites. So basically, it's a Chinese satellite sort of cleaning up itself.
Well, but here's the thing. I keep saying the greatest fortunes of the 21st century will come from space debris. But in 2007, the Chinese basically shot down one of their own satellites to kind of prove that their anti-satellite weaponry worked. Mm-hmm. And it caused a big storm because it did create a whole bunch of space debris. But, you know, my question is, were they trying to deal with a dead satellite or were they trying to prove they could do this?
Right.
Because we're now talking about extraordinary, you know, every day more and more communications, including military operations, depend on low Earth orbit, the satellites. So I think, you know, I don't know if they're just trying to deal with a dead satellite, but what they've been able to prove is now they don't have to explode the satellite. They can just move it out of orbit.
Right.
Right. Right.
Extend R2-D2 up right. there
and
to yank
you,
it.
If you, right. If you look at the sort of the competition over Taiwan, the satellites are very, very important as to who will control the South China Sea and who ultimately will control Taiwan. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so probably a mixed bag. It's obviously in China's interest not to have its satellites destroyed by space debris on the one hand, but on the other hand, you know, just a little saber rattling might have been the motivation right. there just as well.
Right. I think it was saber rattling is my guess, but
yeah,
we'll see. Time will tell.
Time will tell. Okay. Let's go to CBDC and crypto. This first one's kind of interesting, but just we're like, why are you telling me this? This is a paper. A high performance payment processing system designed for central bank digital currencies. So here we go. The feasibility, operating performance, and impact of different CBDC. This paper, by the way, let me back out and
we've talked about this MIT. Before. The Boston Fed and MIT. Well, this is where Gensler was before he went to SEC. So when he left the administration, he left raising money for Hillary Clinton. He went to MIT. MIT had a deal with the Boston Fed, and they've been working on the CBDC. So this is part of the CBDC effort, and they put out this document to. Yeah. Kind of continued the discussion on the technical side of how a CBDC might work.
They call it Project Hamilton. You like that?
So I told you the story. When they took down Hamilton,
yeah.
Ruben, who was a trustee over, we were doing a lot of projects with Brookings. Uh-huh. And as soon as they took down Hamilton, Brookings brought up a Project Hamilton at Brookings. And it was hysterical because, you know, I mean, it was like, okay, you know, want to steal our stuff? No problem. And anyway, so when this turned up as Project Hamilton, I had to laugh. And, you know, in the in-between, we had the Hamilton show on Broadway, which was a huge success. So we've repackaged Hamilton as, you know.
Well, they saw you coming, Fitz. I got bad news for you. They've already got an answer for that. The project is named in tribute to two Hamiltons. Margaret, an MIT computer scientist who led the software development for the Apollo program's guidance system, and Alexander, the other Hamilton, the second.
No, Alexander didn't lay the foundation for the U.S. Central Bank. He laid the foundation for the U.S. financial system, created the Treasury. And, you know, the first thing he did when he created the Treasury, he created the Bureau of Standards and Codes. Okay,
yeah.
So basically, Alexander Hamilton designed and invented the entire U.S. financial system and figured out one of the reasons he wanted a U.S. central bank was they wanted to make sure the European central banks couldn't control. And anyway,
I want to cut back. I've actually got the paper up in PDF form. That's uh-huh. I want to show you something. Like, why are you telling me this? This is from the paper, right up front. Note that our design is not a complete CBDC system. It is neither production ready, nor does it provide all the functionality needed for a working CBDC. It's like, well, what's going on here?
So here's what's going on. Whenever you do something this dramatic and big, you want to engage people in a conversation and a discussion and get feedback.
Yeah.
You know, and you put it out and bring it back and put it out and bring it back and put it out and bring it back. And you can't wait until you got it all figured out.
Right.
You're basically designing in a public process where lots of people get involved. And so what they're doing is the ducks are squawking. They're feeding them in a way that gets them lots of engagement and feedback.
Yeah. That's interesting because that story adds absolutely nothing to the analysis the countless analyses that we've seen before. And I mean zero. There's nothing. It's just like,
but here's the thing. If you can prove when you're ready to roll out your CBDC that you had 50 meetings and you took comments on this and you published this many things. It's process management.
Yeah.
It's field management.
Yeah.
This is PR. Right.
It's PR. Yeah. It's just PR of like, oh, you know, it's we got to get back into the news cycle. Let's put out a story about not having something ready. Isn't that great?
What no, a great story. I think they truly are engaging people.
No, they are.
They're true. I think the guys who are working in that are truly trying to engage people. So.
Yeah, but technically what I'm saying is that they're just like, yeah, we're not ready to go. That's the paper.
Yeah, but here's the thing. There's the people at the MIT and the Boston Fed. But do you really believe that Mitre Corporation and Battelle and all the other groups behind them are going to leave it to them?
No.
Okay. No.
Not okay. In a million years.
So there's another process going on.
Yeah. Right. Right. Okay. Let's cut over to your interview. Can Bitcoin circumvent economic tyranny? Interview with Catherine Austin Fitz and Alex Svetsky. Is that how you pronounce that?
Yeah, Alex Svetsky. He's an Australian. Okay. And, this was, I never dreamed that Joe would let it run for 3 hours. So this was a 3-hour special. And, you know, what I did was, there are many different issues that I think are important to unpack on Bitcoin. But I started by saying, we're just going to talk about whether it contributes to freedom or tyranny. You know, which side is Bitcoin on, and how does it fit into the goal we all have of being free? So what I tried to establish is, you know, all three people engaged in the conversation want to be free. And the question is, how do we get there? And of course, you know, my number one position is we cannot afford an all digital system. Yeah. So, you know, so we could talk all day long about how we would make the digital aspects better. But to me, the number one point is we don't want all digital anyway. So so we talked about this at a policy level, and I took all the issues of how people are getting hurt in Bitcoin and how Bitcoin is still the Wild West in terms of sort of integrity with the individual investor or saver. And I, you know, I kind of parked those and I said, okay, we're just going to look at the policy issue. And it's a frustrating conversation, because when the people you're talking to don't understand how control works and they don't understand financial regulation, you know, it's very hard for somebody who hasn't experienced or understand financial regulation or experienced and understood control the way I have, you know, to try and get them to hear, you know, to understand it. It's pretty funny. And, you know, the people I know who are very intimately familiar with financial regulation who've watched that video are just like, ah! It's very frustrating. Anyway, but it was the beginning of that kind of conversation. And what came out was very interesting at the very end. You know, basically I said, people have value. You know, financial tools have no value. They're just, and this is what's happening with bubbles, John. You know, Mr. Global is printing money and using it in these different bubbles to get people thinking, you know, that stocks have value or crypto has value or, you know, real estate has value, and hating people and thinking people have no value. But, you know, all financial value comes from life. It comes from people. It comes from animals. It comes from plants. It comes from living things. And yet... Right. We have literally used these bubbles to persuade people, you know, that life, you know, is, and you know, or people are expendable. And what I finally said to them in the note that I sent following, look, if the Bitcoin community believes that 80% of the people are lemmings and expendable, what you're saying is you agree that we should let Mr. Global get away with stealing $21 trillion. And then we should turn to the people whose retirement savings and healthcare benefits have been stolen and abrogated and say, oh, well, they're lemmings, they're useless, let's just to hell with them. And I said, it sounds to me like your goal is to help Mr. Global get away with bank robbery.
Yeah.
And
right. The other part is, well, if that life is expendable and all the rest, your currency is backed by the full faith and credit of the United States.
Which is us.
That means
if we have no value. Right. Well, it's interesting because the financial system has become very bubbled and very complex, and people don't really see through it to what's real. I mean, that's one of the things I learned as Assistant Secretary of Housing, because I was dealing with a portfolio that involved, massive home and real estate all over the country. And each situation was a real person and a real family who had a real life and a real story and was going to get hurt if this was managed in an irresponsible way. And, so you see through all the financial gobbledygook into real life and real assets. But that's part of the trance of the bubbles.
It's a total trance. People lose sight of, they get mired in the details so much so they can't see the big picture at all.
Well, but here's the big picture. I may like you or not. I may hate you or not. But I can't be free unless you are. This is a zero or one, all or nothing. Unless humans are free. And that right has to be extended. That's what globalization means. Globalization means that right has to be extended to everybody. So either I as a human have rights or I don't. And we can't take, a small group of people and go off and do Galt's Gulch, which is the place in Atlas Shrugged. I don't know if you ever read Atlas Shrugged. But a group of really smart elite people go off and they create a separate little thing. It's the first breakaway civilization in fiction. So we go off and we create this elite thing and we're free, but to hell with the rest of you. It's never going to work. And one of the reasons is the satellites are over everybody, right? So this theory that we're smarter and better and everybody else is stupid, whether you think you're smarter and everybody else is stupid or not, it doesn't matter. If they're not free, I can't be free. It's an all or nothing thing. I tried to explain when during the litigation, when the $250,000 I'd lent out came back to me, I tried to explain to them, if I'd put that $250,000 in Bitcoin, I would never have made it. It wasn't the money coming back that saved me. It was the people not only sending the money, but not letting me get isolated and not letting the Department of Justice, they were willing to act as witnesses. They were willing to intercede. They were willing to say, no, you can't do that. And their activity, their participation, their caring meant they could never get me completely isolated. And that had nothing to do with money. It was people. And the reason they were willing to do that is because I'd done that for them.
Right.
It wasn't that I gave them $250,000. It was that I was there and I cared and I showed up and I made sure that they weren't harmed in whatever way they were going to get harmed if they didn't have the money. So it wasn't about money.
No. So, it's not just about you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. There's the precedent involved. Like, well, you do know that if you've slit his throat by suppressing his right to free speech, you're next.
Right.
Right. So don't slit your own throat. People don't seem to get that. It's like, oh, I want to win. I want to be on the winning team. It's like, you're missing
the
point.
Well, the whole point of divide and conquer is to keep us from getting together and realizing, we're in this together. And whatever is going on, we are in this together. So.
Yep, you got it.
Yeah.
All right, in it together. Let's go to the next segment, which is pushback. Which is a good segment. Although this first story is a little crazy. It's out of China. This is a one sentence story, basically. China orders arrest of AstraZeneca official over fraud. That sounds great, right? Yeah. Until you read it, it's like China has now ordered the arrest of AstraZeneca officials over charges of fraud. So far, so good. The organization, okay, so that's got to mean AstraZeneca, because China is not an organization, has taken disciplinary measures against those employees, okay, so that it confirms that is AstraZeneca, and has reported their offenses to the authorities. Okay, so what's going on? I take it AstraZeneca investigated itself.
So the reason I wanted this story in was that our interview this week is with an Indian attorney who's a member of a group called the Indian Bar Association, which is a private group of attorneys. It's not the Indian official bar association as we know it in the United States.
Uh-huh.
They've brought two lawsuits against related to the AstraZeneca injections. And remember, those companies do not have liability protection in India or China. And so we have two lawsuits that are quite significant and serious, and they're bringing it against Bill Gates, you know, individually, personally. So if we start to see these kinds of lawsuits in countries where there is no liability protection, it could get very interesting.
Yeah, that story, though, raises the question of like, well, it's like a lot of U.S. stories. When it comes, you've kind of scratched the surface of an alleged investigation, and it's the company investigating itself. And that's exactly what that story is. AstraZeneca invested itself and said, hey, here's some heads to chop, you know, some. And China's right. Like, yeah, we're game.
Okay. Sure. Right.
You know, so there's more going on there than meets the eye.
Yes, there's absolutely more going on there. Somebody probably got bribed. But
yeah.
But this goes back to the life insurance and what's happening. This is starting to open up. It's starting to open up. And you're starting to see the percolation of people contemplating real legal pushback and real legal liability.
Yeah. So, you know, that story may be sacrificial lambs. That may be the thin edge of a wedge. Time will tell. But remember, it is a company investigating itself. Wall Street did the same thing.
But you know something? When you throw employees over the, you know, that's what you do. You know, the head chopping starts at the fringe and works its way in. But as soon as everybody knows we could get chopped for the party line, you know, guess what happens?
Same thing in the U.S. You start flipping people from the bottom up.
Right.
Right. You flip witnesses and get this guy to rat his boss out and on up all the way to the top. In theory, in practice, it doesn't happen precisely because the companies are investigating themselves. Like you're what? Please. Anyway.
I don't know. You know, if government money bought those vaccines, you could be talking about a lot of people who see opportunity in key TAMs is what I'm hoping.
We shall see.
Yeah. Let's see. Okay.
All right.
I'm waiting to get to the Moderna stock chart.
We'll get to it, but we have to go to a high school. We have a video here of some students who are displeased with the mask mandate in their school. Here we go.
Hey! Everybody shut up!
Pay attention.
This is not an excuse for any of you freshmen and sophomores to disrespect your teachers. If I hear of anybody disrespecting teachers or staff tomorrow, that makes us look bad. We want this to be a peaceful, respectful movement. We are just trying to gain back our rights as citizens. We do not care about the teachers. In the end, are just doing their jobs. It doesn't come from them. It comes from the state. Now, what we're hoping is that they kick us out. This sounds bad, but we're hoping that they kick us out because they have to report that attendance to the state. And if the state sees a day where 100 or I don't even know how many kids are here are absent, they're going to start asking questions. Our hope is we can get this statewide. Now, I might get in trouble for this, but the plan still stands for Wednesday. For tomorrow, I mean. Everybody is going to meet at the back row of the senior parking lot, and we're all walking into the school with no mask on. You can get me in trouble. They can suspend me. I don't care. We're done with this. And obviously, all of you are, too.
Shut up. Shut up.
Obviously, all you are done with the mask, too. Now, again, we're doing this peacefully and respectfully. If a staff member asks you to put a mask on, you say no thank you and keep walking. And if they kick you out, then go home. And if people need rides home, then some of the seniors, I'm sure we can start giving people rides home. That's about it.
That's it.
Okay, so if the students leave, they got a cash flow problem.
Yeah, right.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
But so they know where to hit him. And he knew something about the system, too. Like, They're going to see attendance blips, and they're going to start asking questions.
Right, and that's a cash flow problem.
Yeah.
State's going to start pulling money, right?
Right, but that's it's a knowledgeable protest, you know, and that's what it takes. You got to know where your enemy's weak, and that guy damn sure did. Let's keep it going, though, and go over to Canada. Military tells Ottawa to find someone else to evict the truckers. I love this. The military's like, nah, I don't think so. Despite the Ottawa police, so here's the police, briefly raised the possibility of a military intervention to clear a stubborn holdout of Freedom Convoy truckers blockading their downtown. The Canadian Armed Forces have been quick to say they will be doing no such thing. You know, they've had problems with protests in the military before over there. Freedom Convoy still refuses to leave Ottawa until Ottawa meets their not tremendously realistic demands of ending all COVID strictures, even the ones Ottawa didn't impose. And thus, the downtown Ottawa effectively remains closed with businesses shuttered and people urging traffic, police avoiding.
I don't know if you saw the latest headline. You ready for this? You know, the police have been confiscating gas that people are bringing to the truckers.
Yeah.
A judge just ruled, according to the headline, that the police have to give the gas back.
Yeah.
Right. That's indicated. Yeah.
Yeah, it's more judicial pushback, you see. You know, and so it's like, well, this is, you guys are losing steam, but, you know, which is great. It's great to see judges finally waking up out of a lacuna that's gone on. It's really more like a coma. They've been in.
Well, I just saw an announcement. Some of the provinces are now rolling back the mandates, the vaccination mandates. So,
yeah. But you're not out of the woods.
No.
You know, you just got to keep pressing on. The next, I want to go to the Canadian Mountie story, but I'm going to need to. So here's this guy, this corporate Bulford resigns from his position, and I've got it queued up. You could see there at the 10:51 mark, but I'm going to need the or 51 mark. I'm going to need to make a quick change to the audio because it's coming from a different source. So this will work. Got to be able to hear it. There we go. And let me go back over to our guy. And I just want to play just a few seconds of this to hear where he's coming from. There he is, Trudeau's personal security.
And I would like to just read the paragraph 3 of the Emergencies Act to you. Whereas the Governor and Council, in taking such special temporary measures, would be subject to the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms and the Canadian Bill of Rights, and must have regard to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, particularly with respect to those fundamental rights that are not to be limited or abridged, even in a national emergency. I recently heard former Premier of Newfoundland, Brian Peckford, say very clearly that they have failed to demonstrably justify their infringements on our fundamental freedom. There's many, but I'll hit on the key ones that I think are germane to the current situation. Our mobility rights, where every citizen has the right to enter, remain in, and leave Canada. Our legal rights, everyone has the right to life, liberty, and security of person, and the right not to be deprived thereof, except in accordance with the principles of fundamental justice. Section 8, everyone has the right to be secure against unreasonable search or seizure. That's a big one in the police world. And when I read that, I can't help but think of people who are not even law enforcement demanding your private medical information at the door of a hockey rink.
Okay, so you kind of get it there. It's principled resistance. This guy, it's not some willy-nilly guy. You know, he's coming from, he read the law of Canada, which is obviously, you know, bears some similarity to the law in the U.S., and saying, you know, this is you're out of bounds, and I'm going to check
you. Well, but, you know, he didn't mention it, but what he has also seen is all the many times that Trudeau has broken his own rules. So he knows Trudeau is not, you know, is not obeying the rules that he's inflicting on the Canadians illegally.
Yeah.
And so that for someone in this position to do it, this is a very courageous thing to do.
Absolutely.
Right.
That's a major position to be the security guard for the prime minister.
Right.
I mean, that's going to cost him.
Right.
You know,
that's a brave man.
That's a guy who's willing to go to the mat because that probably cost him just that right there. A few million dollars, in compensation. Right. That's a young guy. I mean, I'm looking at him right now. He's 30, 35 maybe. He's got a long way to go. He just gave up a lot of income.
He gave up a lot of income, a lot of friends.
Yeah. Okay. So let's go over to, where is it? Here we go. I love this. This is another great story from Celia Farber. GoFundMe backs down under threat of DeSantis fraud investigation. Now, I don't think she's hot. She's kind of pissed in this article. I didn't really kind of get it. But how do you have a crowdfunding business which, when the crowd raises funds, you then subject to robbery based on ideological posturing? You see, she's personally involved in this. I used it, GoFundMe, to raise funds for my original blog website. It was sent several hundred dollars in donations by readers of the site. Suddenly, GoFundMe stopped these transactions. Okay, so the transactions stopped. That's not what happened with GoFundMe. What happened with GoFundMe is they just took the money, right? So she's happy that Governor Ron DeSantis and others stepped in.
Here's what they did. They sent a message to the donors, and they said, if you want a refund, you have to file and request it. Otherwise, we're going to work with the truckers to agree to a group of charities to give the money away. So we're going to give the money away to a group of charities you never agreed to or approved, unless you go to the trouble of filing a document and requesting a refund. And God knows how long it'll take to get it, which is, to me, is robbery. I mean, it's just...
That's right. It's not that GoFundMe stopped the donations in this case.
Right.
They're stealing the donations.
They're stealing the money. stealing the money.
And it's
the Roach Motel again.
This case is fraud. Her case about stopping the funds, that's not fraud. That's just a jerk business.
Right.
Fraud's a different... Fraud puts it into the arena of criminal. Right.
Right.
I mean, it can, potentially. There's both criminal and civil fraud. And so I think that's probably why GoFundMe backed down on this one.
You know something? I can't think of a company doing more to harm its brand than what GoFundMe did on this.
I know.
They're in serious... I would never use GoFundMe. I would never donate on GoFundMe. I would never use GoFundMe. It's like, it's over.
Yeah.
They're over.
Yeah, they had that kind of Facebook aroma about them.
Right.
To me from the beginning, and I just stayed away. I would never have used them, but boy,
well,
after
I stayed away after Celia, after what they did to Celia. It was on, I think I gave some of the money on that one.
Well,
I don't know.
Or maybe you didn't, because they stopped it, you know.
Right.
Anyway, let's keep it going. This is a great story because it follows up on a story we had just last week, right? About the IRS facial recognition. That went down in flames. Wall Street Journal, IRS retreats from facial recognition to verify taxpayers' identities. How about that? Yeah. IRS commissioner, here he is. The commissioner said, we are quickly pursuing short-term options that do not involve facial recognition. The IRS is scrapping its use of private facial recognition system to authenticate taxpayers' identities for online accounts, the agency said Monday, after criticism from lawmakers in both parties over privacy concerns. Yeah, it's lawmakers of both parties, but it's a little more specific than that. The IRS has been using the service from a company called ID.me, as we explained last week. And here you go, Mike Crapo, from Republican from Idaho, who's the ranking member on the Senate Finance Committee. The IRS has unilaterally decided to allow an outside contractor to stand as the gatekeeper between citizens and necessary government services, he writes. And then Ron Wyden, who's the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. So the two most powerful members on the Senate Finance Committee, representing both parties, are all over the IRS. And Wyden says the government can treat Americans with respect and dignity while protecting against fraud and identity theft, he writes. And of course, he invariably gets brownie points. He raises concerns about racial and gender bias. Of course, you know, like, guy, stay on point. But anyway, it's good to see resistance.
Push back against biometric, push back against digital IDs, push back. I've checked with our CPA. We're going to file all paper You know, no online filings in Texas this year, all paper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great.
File paper. Just let's get out of the digital space.
Yeah, let's get out of the digital space is right. Okay, the next story, it's a video. This is actually, we're bringing back, that's it for, that IRS story, by the way, is it for pushback. We're going to move bring back diluting the brand.
This one is priceless.
For a one-time encore here. I'm just going to roll this video. The video is long. It's about 5 minutes. But we need to go a couple minutes into it to sort of get it, and then I'll pull it. But this is just fantastic. All right, here we go.
Thanks. Okay, well, that's quite a mouthful there. So you said actions such as these suggest otherwise. Suggest meaning that they suggest they're not interested in talks and they're going to go ahead with some kind of a... What action are you talking about?
One, the actions I've just pointed to. The fact that Russia continues to engage in disinformation campaigns.
You've made an allegation that they might do that. Have they actually done it?
What we know, Matt, is what I have just said, that they have engaged in this activity, because obviously this is not the first time we've made these reports public. You'll remember that just a few weeks ago.
I'm sorry. Made what report public?
If you'll let me finish, I will tell you what report we made public. We told you a few weeks ago that we have information indicating Russia also has already prepositioned a group of operatives to conduct a false flag operation in eastern Ukraine. So that, Matt, to your question, is an action that Russia has already taken.
It's an action that you say that they have taken, but you have shown no evidence to confirm that. And I'm going to get to the next question here, which is, what is the evidence that they... I mean, this is like crisis actors, really? This is like Alex Jones territory you're getting into now. What evidence do you have to support the idea that there is some propaganda film in the making?
Matt, this is derived from information known to the U.S. government, intelligence information that we have declassified. I think you know...
Okay, well, where is it? Where is this information?
It is intelligence information that we have declassified.
Well, where is it? Where is the declassified information?
I just delivered it.
No, you made a series of allegations and
would
statements.
Would you like us to print out the topper? Because you will see a transcript of this briefing that you can print out for yourself.
That's not evidence, Ned. That's you saying it. That's not evidence. I'm sorry.
What would you like, Matt?
I would like to see some proof that you can show.
Okay. Anyway, you get it. It goes on like that for quite a while. Your allegations aren't evidence.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we've watched for many, many years. So from 2016 on, allegations against the Russians being used in the most ridiculous and absurd ways again and again and again. And now, you know, there used to be a time when if a White House press person or a State Department press person said, we have reason to believe, they would be taken seriously. Now it's just considered to be puffery. In other words, saying they have intelligence of something is considered totally meaningless unless you have independent evidence and confirmation.
Right.
So what it's saying is the brand is worthless.
It's what it says to me as an attorney is that the reporters are now looking at the White House, the executive branch, or the government as a party, kind of in a litigation. Like, now you got to prove up your statements,
right?
You know, you're not some official source. We're not going to take judicial notice just of what you say. Right. You got to prove what you're saying. You're an interested party here.
Right.
That's a material shift. Because it really represents like, well, you know, who's talking here?
It's not really the government. It's an unbelievable shift.
We're treating you like a corporation.
Right.
Because that, in essence, is what you are. Well, you want to act like a corporation, we'll treat you like one.
You're basically a PR person who's got a nuclear arsenal.
Yeah.
It's kind of scary. But you're
first and foremost, from our point of view, you're a PR person, i.e. a corporate agent.
Right.
Not an agent of the government. That ship has sailed.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's the brand they destroyed.
Yeah. That's a great clip. Right. But I mean, it's funny, but that does represent a tectonic shift in this country. I think it's like the distrust of the government it's reached such a level that it's right out in the open now with reporters.
Well, the interesting thing is it was the reporters who let it happen, who created it. In other words, you know, this took a partnership between the media and the administration. And now we see one reporter at least who's willing to walk out of the model.
Matt Lee is his name.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. You ready for charts?
Yeah. Let's right. Charts are interesting this week. Charts
are interesting. They are. All right, let's hit it. What have we got?
Okay, so we just wanted to take a look, and we did this since last September. We just wanted to take a look at the sort of recent trading in the equity markets. So equity markets not strong. So we see the S&P flat, Europe down about 3.5%, China down about five and three quarters. So the U.S. continues to outtrade Europe and China, but nobody's looking good in the equity markets right now.
Yeah, I'd say. Yeah. There's nobody's in the black at all.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Not on that chart. I mean, the highest on one is minus 0.03%. Okay, let's keep it going. Next chart, the pharmaceuticals.
Okay, so...
Wow.
Moderna since September. So remember, it wasn't that long ago. Doctors for COVID Ethics said mRNA technology needs to, you know, is a bad idea across the board. It needs to die. And of course, that's the, you know, the total bet at Moderna. So that's the bottom December. Stock is Moderna, which since last September is down 60%.
Boy.
Yeah, that's that was quite a pump and dump. But down 60% is pretty strong. So Pfizer is still...
trucking away.
Yeah, still trucking away. It's a much bigger company, but...
yeah.
You know, don't be surprised if the insurance company announcements keep coming out, if we're going to see Pfizer in the basement as well.
That would surprise me.
It'll be interesting to watch to see.
It will be. That would surprise me. Okay.
Yeah.
Up
now,
next.
One thing I will say... When a stock drops this much, when the employees are depending on stock options, and you got a lot of investors who are pissed, you know, information starts leaking out. So if that stock continues to stay down or fall further, you could see a lot of interesting information about what Moderna's really been up to start to leak out.
Yeah.
Okay. So I wanted to take another look at the payment providers. We see... Meta, you know, former Facebook, really dive in the beginning of February, along with more diving of PayPal and Block, which is the old Square. So PayPal now down since September, 58%.
Wow.
Yeah. So you wonder I continue to want to know what's really going on behind the scenes vis-a-vis the payment companies. So, you know, sort of how the cash flows are going to work and who's going to be transacting in the digital space it's very, very fluid. So PayPal's under a lot of pressure. And of course, they irritated more than a few people last year with throwing people off and putting much more draconian. You know, all the payment providers are asking for ridiculous and draconian, unnecessary terms.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah.
So,
and of course, you wonder, you know, why did Mr. Global get mad at Mark Zuckerberg?
Yeah, that's a major company. Down. I mean, that's a huge company. That's one of the biggest cash cows in the U.S.
But here's the thing: absolutely no attention. I pay absolutely no attention to Facebook. I try and pretend it doesn't exist. You know, and if it keeps having months like this, it won't exist. So,
I take that back. I was thinking of Amazon when I was saying cash cow. I don't know how.
You know, Amazon and Apple are doing just, and Google are all doing just fine.
Those are the three biggest cash cows in the U.S.
Right. But there's somebody's getting punished severely in the digital payment space. And so I just keep watching this and trying to figure out what exactly is going on behind the scenes. Okay, next, let's take a look at the next one.
This is the euro versus the dollar.
Yeah, so the dollar's been strengthening against the euro. The euro's been declining.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because the euro is the only currency that really can take real sort of market share away from the U.S. dollar in terms of being a reserve currency. So euro's number two and euro falling against the dollar. And this is got to be connected with what's happening with Russia and the energy story.
Yeah. So the other side, the flip side of that is, you know, it costs a dollar. A euro is $1.14 right now.
Right.
Right.
Right. So okay. Next chart.
Yeah.
Do we have Bitcoin? I thought we were going to end with inflation. Did you have the Bitcoin chart?
No, I don't have the Bitcoin.
Okay, chart. Well, we'll look at it. I just wanted to point out, I had a Bitcoin chart in here that last November it peaked at 67,000, and then last week was at 37,000, and you know, a lot of people being pressured to buy Bitcoin, and just remember, it can swing. You know, it can swing in a couple months down 40 or 50%. So just be prepared. Okay, let's go back to inflation. You know, I love the inflation chart.
Here we go.
And it says the same thing it's been saying every week we put it up, which is,
well, there's an interesting shift this week. Look at Mr. VIX. He's risen from the basement.
Yep.
He appears to be in the elevator, headed up.
Yep.
One. And our buddy Lumber has moved from, you know, I think the middle of the chart up to, he's moving up. But the top of the chart is the same as it always is every single week, week in and week out. Oats and coffee and energy with...
Basically, if you're a trucker, cotton, you know, your oatmeal and coffee and gas is costing you a lot more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, you know, the preponderance of this chart is green, you know, not so much red. So that tells you everything you need to know about inflation. It is on. Yep.
It is definitely, inflation's on. Inflation is absolutely on. And you know, you said it would be when we looked at the, you know, the amount of printing coming into going direct reset, it was baked into the cake. And that's what you've been saying all along.
Yeah. It's not going anywhere.
Right.
Yeah. I don't care what you do with your interest rates. You're not tamping down inflation. You can't get that genie back in the bottle.
No.
Nope. Nope. Sorry. Nope. For retail dollars. The whole reason the genie's out of the bottle is people were dumping treasuries and they were dumping mortgage-backed securities. You do to reverse it and to get that money supply back down, you now have to convince people, hey, sell your stock and go buy treasuries and buy mortgage-backed securities. What are the odds of that?
I don't know. They just put in the head of NATO to run the Norwegian wealth fund. Maybe that's what they're hoping.
You
can get the Norwegians to buy treasuries. Good luck with that.
Anyway.
Okay, anyway, John.
That's it.
See you next week. Thank you so much for joining us on Money and Markets.
Next week will be sovereignty.
That's right. That's right. We're coming out with the theme. Oh, I wanted to thank everybody. We just got a new round. You know, while PayPal is going down, Cash and Coin is going up. So we're now almost at about 12% of our subscribers are in Cash and Coin, and we thank you so much for that.
That makes a big difference, yeah.
Yeah, and it all came out of PayPal. Anyway, but next week, John and I are going to record the annual wrap-up theme on sovereignty, which is, you know, sovereignty is at the heart of currency. And the law is at the heart of currency. And it's something that's really not thought about or discussed. And what I'm seeing around the world, and the truckers are helping to do this, is bring home the point, if there's no rule of law, nothing can work. So you've got to come back to, are we sovereign individuals under rule of law? Are we just livestock in the middle of chaos? Right. It all comes back to law. Right. Well, that's this thing about, if you want to be free, then if I want to be free, you got to be free. It's an all or nothing kind of thing. And we have to, we're going to be the ones to enforce the covenant of the rule of law. Has to be.
We have to be. And we'll talk about that in the sovereignty presentation. Fear plays a role in sovereignty both ways. It's right. Interesting. Yep.
Right. Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to it.
It's going to be a good one.
See you next week. Thanks,
John. See you next week. All right. Bye.